All right. Well, welcome back to another episode of the Groundings podcast. As always, I'm your host, Devin Springer. And today I have with me a guest I'm really excited to have on. We've been trying to schedule this interview for like a few weeks now, really a few months. But she's really busy and she's international. So not only is she traveling a lot, but we have a huge time difference because she's coming to you today via London. But I have with me Annie Tariba, who is going to talk about her essay, which is titled Afro-Pessimism and the Unlogic of Anti-Blackness, which is a wonderful, principled, and well-laid-out critique of Afro-Pessimism, which I think is just really important. And anyone engaging in Black studies, and in, especially in 2018, who's engaging in these ideas at all, should read this essay. And it gives you a lot of considerations to take away. But before continuing, I'm going to let Annie go ahead and introduce herself and say hey.
Hi, I'm Annie. As Devin said, I'm based in London. I was at university before. At the moment, I'm applying to start my master's program. But I'm not, I'm sort of an independent researcher at the moment.
First, and for everyone listening, if you haven't read this essay yet, I'm going to definitely link it in the bio of the podcast, and I'll share it once again on Twitter too, but I'll make sure it's in the bio and you can just click on the link. But Annie, this essay is a bit long, and I mean that in like the best way possible. Like you didn't just disparage of the ideology or the school of thought of Afro-Pessimism. You really engaged it, I think, in a very principled and dedicated way. So can you just first tell me what kind of inspired you to write this essay and take on this school of thought that's becoming super popular?
I think there were a few things. So I wrote the abstract for the essay, or the submission for the essay, in 2016, and it only just came out this year, so a lot's happened in the intermediary period. Essentially, at the time, I was sort of taking a step back from everything on the left, from being involved in movements, and I then was in a really weird position of still being at university and also watching how things were going down in the organizations that I used to be involved in. One of the main ones was a group called Rogue Must Fall in Oxford. And for me, it was this frustrating situation because most of my friends who were still involved were sort of what will now be termed non-Black POC. And watching what they went through, particularly like POC women, was really like, it really lit a fire in me and made me feel really angry, and it made me feel like I had to write something about it. I mean, I'd had sort of inklings of the direction that this politics was going to go, and I guess it came to the UK probably a bit later than it did to the US. But I sort of had inklings of the direction this politics was going to go when we started sort of separating issues that were distinctively Black from all other issues around questions of racism and imperialism. And at the time, I was also writing my dissertation for my undergraduate course on sort of gender politics within the Panthers, but that also opened up my eyes to this whole world of and national liberation politics. It gave me an opportunity to read Fanon closer than I'd ever been able to do before. And because there was like nobody at the institution, I went to a very white institution, there was no one at the institution really who was able to guide me through that process. A lot of it was like readings of my own and sort of having to like come to terms with a lot of the questions I'd had from organizing in my sort of own space, reading people that I just not had the opportunity to get around to reading closely enough, but had been cited loads in movements I've been a part of. And so I guess when I came to link anti-Blackness theory to Afro-Pessimism and some of the languages and logics of Afro-Pessimism, that was sort of the point at which I realized that, like, first of all, as a movement contemporarily, it feels like racial liberation politics is suffering from a sort of like amnesia or just a disconnect from their sort of intellectual history of Black liberation as sort of grounded within the broader context of national liberation politics. And so I felt like that I needed to contribute in some way to retrieving some of that tradition, because it was so incredible to me when I was reading it, so inspiring to me. And I felt like a lot of my peers were missing out on that. And then the other thing was just realizing that, I mean, when I first started university, I was sort of skeptical about identity politics, however broad and sort of difficult to pin down that term is. But we sort of made a strategic decision where we defend it aggressively against the right and also against what a lot of people who are involved in our organization who had the sense that we needed to be better at liberation politics, but were also sort of class first Marxists at heart, and so needed that sort of education. And so, but watching how that developed over time, and then getting to the point that I was, where I was like, actually now this politics has become hegemonic for people who want to talk about liberation, for people who want to resist the status quo, and we have to get better at fighting it, and fighting it can only mean arming ourselves with the kind of arguments against it. And actually you found that when those debates were happening, I mean, there was a massive debate around the same time around political blackness in the UK, which a lot of Americans are sort of just don't really understand it. But there was a tradition coming out of the 60s, 70s, particularly in the UK, of all POC identifying themselves as politically black. And that comes from an understanding of black. I mean, it comes from an understanding of black as not anything but political, right? There's no blackness which precedes the political in that sense. But also it was like a means for organizing against fascism in the UK. And within the student movement, it became a big debate, because that the National Union of Students was one of the last places where you had the definition of black in a political sense, as opposed to sort of the ethnic identity, which has like come down from this sort of state approach here. And even for the people who wanted to defend it, even for the people who wanted to argue for the importance of unity, for the importance of a political unity against racism, they didn't really know how to articulate it because they hadn't read the text. In a sort of elitist way, but I mean that in the sense of we have to learn from the people who came before us, and if we're not to try and reinvent the wheel in our generation, we have to engage with those texts, and no one was, and so the debate just disintegrated, and the National Students Union's Black Student Campaign committed itself to changing its name, which was just a frustration. So all of these things sort of converged around that 2016 point, and I was like, I have to sit down and write something about it. And in a slightly crude way, partly because I was like, I'm a black woman, and I get to say a lot more things around this question than most people do. A lot of my friends had been like invited and disinvited for things on the charge of anti-blackness, simply for like comparing black struggles to other struggles. So I was like, if we're gonna make this space, somebody has to sort of take the step to try and push for that in the UK context. And actually the first draft of the article was thinking a lot about the UK context, and it was the editors that sort of pushed me to think more broadly about it and the implications of it, which really helped me.
And I think it's interesting that, you know, just to give context to the listeners, the first time I ever engaged with you actually, if you recall, was an argument on Twitter. Not so much of an argument, more like a kind of heated exchange about intersectionality. And this was maybe 2 years ago, actually. And I was still sort of invested in almost projecting a liberatory or revolutionary position onto intersectionality instead of taking it for what it was. And you know, you were sort of, well, not even sort of, you were literally schooling me. And so I think that's a really interesting framework, though, because it was one of those things where, like you just said, you as a black woman, you had the ability and the range, and due to this sort of quote-unquote intersectional and quote-unquote Afro-pessimist mindset in which the world works nowadays, you were sort of allowed to do that, right? Like, you were disparaging and being critical of intersectionality in ways that myself as a Black man, I can't do and I wouldn't be allowed to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things, for a lot of my writing, there's a lot of things about my sort of background, my history that I don't talk about deliberately because I still feel like part of the frustration I have with politics, like intersectionality and the sort of power politics of who gets to speak in political movements is the fact that there is an automatic assumption that if the primary epistemological frame is experience, then people like us aren't worthy of rigor or of like serious scholarly inquiry, right? So like I sort of try to put all of that on the back foot because all of a sudden the standards get lowered. And it was actually really interesting to see some of the sort of reviewers' comments on the initial draft of my argument of my article, because I do have a suspicion that a few of them thought I was like a random white dude.
That's fascinating. I think that, yeah, I mean, the politics of who can say what, right, or quote unquote taking up space, which has been completely divorced from its original conception, by the way, it dominates such a large faction of our movement spaces. Not to get off topic, but to give you an example of what I mean by this, 2 or 3 years ago, I was at an organizing meeting with neighborhood associations in Atlanta against gentrification and capitalist development. There was this, it was almost all Black and Latino people, but there was this one older white couple who were very poor, working class, and who had lived in this neighborhood for almost 40 years now. So at the very end of the meeting, they spoke up and said, hey, I think you misunderstand this point. As someone who's lived here this long and who's impacted by this, I just want to make sure we can correct that. And instantly, I watched many Black activists and organizers in the room say, oh, you're taking up too much space, or you don't understand because you're not Black. That's not our, we don't have the same experiences. So it became this sort of like power struggle based on the notion of experience versus material analysis. And you had these privileged Black college students telling these extremely poor working class white people, you know, that they didn't know they were talking about, even though they lived in the neighborhood that, that was being impacted. So
it's shocking. It's so really shocking.
It was jarring. And I think that these kind of, this framework is so inadequate because that experience becomes the norm. And I mean, just to segue from there, I want to get into your article because we've already sort of covered a lot of the points you discuss in it. What I find interesting is you actually start off the article talking about the 2015 Chapel Hill murder of the young Muslims, which, again, a conversation around Afro-pessimism, anti-Blackness, beginning with non-Black Muslims in the U.S. at least, could be very controversial or offensive to some. But what you do is phenomenal, and you discuss the rise of the hashtag Muslim Lives Matter and how that created an outcry and people claiming that that was anti-Blackness and they were erasing Black Lives Matter. So can you kind of talk about your introduction to this piece and why you chose to introduce it like that and sort of the thinking behind that?
The reason I chose this story, in large part, very briefly, is simply because I thought it perfectly encapsulated what exactly was wrong with this kind of politics. You have a case of people who are reaching, and we have to understand as that, like, as anybody who's interested in liberatory politics, moments like this are deeply politicizing for large parts of any population, right? And it's precisely in those moments that people reach for the language that's available to them, either in popular culture or sort of online communities that they're involved in, to try and express that anger and channel that energy. And here you have an example of something which has been done for like generations and generations before us, reaching for a language, showing the similarity or commonality between two forms of, and I don't necessarily think they're that different considering the fact that the majority of Muslims in America are Black, But like reaching for that language, showing that commonality and being beaten back purely, I mean, and this is the innovation that I find so frustrating, purely because of the notion that to compare in and of itself is anti-Black. And the sort of quote that I pulled out sort of tells us, I thought it told me two things. First of all, that some of the people who most aggressively police who gets to speak and doesn't get to speak around questions of anti-Blackness are precisely the people who get referred to as non-Black POC. And secondly, because the underlying assumption is in order to justify this, the claim just has to be true that Black people are categorically more oppressed than anybody else in the world. And that's ridiculous when you, well, first of all, it's ridiculous to sort of carve out this separate category, which is what I talk about later on, given the like diversity of different forms of experiences or contacts with white supremacy and imperialism that this group of people has faced. But secondly, when Muslims, like South Asian Muslims, Arabs in America are experiencing things that the Black population in America have experienced in their history, presumably that is precisely the moment that you spot the linkages, that is precisely the moment you join the dots, that precisely the moment that you start talking about universalism. And that sort of retreat into particularism is something that I was really interested in centering in the article as a sort of phenomenon of contemporary identity politics.
And I think that, not to cut you off, I want to just say, comparing that moment with historical examples, right? The Black Panthers, there was the creation of the White Panther Party, you know, after the Black Panther Party was created, inspired by the Black Panthers, and they were welcomed with open arms, right? Like it wasn't, they didn't say you're appropriating us or whatever else may have been said. Comparing that, it's a stark contrast in where we are.
Yeah.
Which, like you said, it's critically important because this is a politicization moment, really.
Yeah, and I think the other aspect is that the sort of moment that the Panthers are operating in, it's a moment which centers Blackness, right, as a political battleground in which, I mean, even members of the Chinese government at the time are talking about the African American population as being in a historically unique position being the only group fighting for liberation without a claim to land, and that right. them in the position to a unique position in terms of arguing for questions of universal freedom and universal liberation, right? And so I think the aim there was to sort of counterpose like two sort of scenarios in which you have the particular being centered but to very different ends. The particular was centered in the case of the Panthers to drive us towards universal conclusions, and the particular is being centered contemporarily to, I don't want to think about it in the frame of like separate, but it is fundamentally to break down the possibility of solidarity.
No, I 100% agree. I mean, to bring in another example, I don't know if you remember in 2014 when MIA, the rapper from UK, in an interview, she said everyone is allowed to say Black Lives Matter, but it would be very unpopular to say Muslim Lives Matter. Why aren't people talking about Muslim lives and refugee lives, right? Which, of course, I think the languaging of that could have been much better and much different. But the sentiment resonates. I mean, this is someone who her whole career has sort of been uplifting this same narrative of like refugees, Muslims, they're not advocated for, especially in the West. And she used hip hop as the linkage to connect it to this sort of Black radical tradition that has flourished through hip hop. Around the same time of the Chapel Hill shooting, she was similarly disparaged. And since then, I mean, her career has suffered. Black people have, you know, turned her into a joke. Or not Black people, I should say, more so that kind of Black liberal class that likes to use that policing of language. Yeah. And this is someone who had built, to me, a career and legacy of solidarity. I think more than it just breaking solidarity, it can cause these sort of profound alienations as well.
Certainly. And I think it is where like political space is centered around this competitiveness, right? you push people closer and closer. So people who instinctively want to find commonality, people who instinctively want to find ground for solidarity, you push them closer and closer to a position in which they feel like if they are going to make an intervention, that intervention has to be that they represent the more abject group, right? And that's not really helpful to anyone, because even if we found the most oppressed group in society, where does that take us politically? What does that teach us politically? And I think that's the sort of question. I definitely think that in these kind of framings, or that what's going on at the moment, it's certainly linked to a sense that I feel, which is that a lot of people have sort of abdicated a responsibility to win in a sense. So like I was having a debate, actually I was giving a paper this weekend, and I remember having a debate afterwards where I was just like, okay, like even if everything that the Afro-pessimists say is true, where does that take us politically? I mean, I think it's, but like the question is like, where does it take us politically? And for me, I come from a tradition, or I come out of reading a tradition which sees the like politically correct or politically accurate and the strategic as one and the same, which sees valuable thought and the like strategically progressing as one as this like one and the same.
Mm-hmm. I certainly agree. So I think from there we can move into sort of the actual logics of the article and what you point out as major problems in this thinking, beyond what we've just spoken generally about, you know, things and topics that are brought up in the essay. But I would like to get into some of the specifics of it. One of the early points you make, there's two kind of early parallel points you make. One is that the language of Afro-pessimism is nearly impenetrable, meaning it's written like a poet's professor's master of all time of language is writing it. And, you know, this, me and you, we're two sort of educated, quote unquote, I hate using that, but two educated people who say that, right? So then for the rest of the world, what does that mean? Like, I will read one thing by an Afro-pessimist or a proclaimed Afro-pessimist, and it takes me an hour to get through a few paragraphs sometimes. And then two, that it's almost undefinable or intentionally vague in a sense in many areas. So for the listeners who might not be familiar with this body of work and who might not be in the world of sort of Black studies, can you give an overview of what you and your article are describing as Afro-pessimism?
Okay, so I'm talking about, there are a few distinctions I think it's important to make. So essentially when I talk about Afro-pessimism, I talk about the sort of body of work that springs forth from primarily Frank Wilderson, or around his work, but also like thinkers like Jared Sexton. And essentially their sort of contribution is the notion that Blackness represents a state of ontological non-being, which people could be forgiven for not understanding what that means, but essentially it's like Black, to be Black is to be socially dead, is to live but not be able to participate in any meaningful sense in the world, in politics. And so it's a category which is counterposed to the very notion of human. And their intervention is essentially to try to say that we've talked for really long when we talk about liberation politics about integrating Blackness or integrating Black people into the category of human through like sort of incremental gains, but actually that very integration is impossible because the sort of category of human needs an abject in order to survive, or needs a counterpart in order to survive. I hope that makes sense. I mean, it's difficult, right? Because Frank Wilderson was actually supposed to respond to my piece. And he replied to the editor saying that he was going to read it with an eye to responding. And his response was essentially that I didn't talk enough about the libidinal economy in my article, and therefore it made me an unworthy opponent. And I had to sort of make a decision.
That you didn't talk enough about what?
I didn't engage with the sort of Afro-pessimist logic around the libidinal economy and how sort of Blackness is built through that frame. I guess for me, I had to make a decision. I mean, I had a lot of conversations and a lot of people around me weren't who were reading through the piece before it went to the reviewers weren't engaged or enmeshed in those sort of debates. And I had them read it because I was like, either I'm going to write a piece which takes me in a circle back to point zero because no one can actually understand it when they read it, or I have to sort of do some of the work to try and translate it, which is the sort of role I was sort of trying to take on. And also mm-hmm. I just think that like that in the sort of impenetrability of it, you get a lot of stuff which might bamboozle someone at first, might sound nice to think about, poetic even, but actually if you get to the core of it, it's a very simple idea. What they're trying to claim, they're trying to make a very simple set of claims, which I think are refutable. Mm-hmm. But that sort of facade of dense texts filled with like words that they've coined for themselves is actually just a sort of means to move the goalposts every time someone tries to respond.
I think that's a very important point. And I think that the intention of even creating resources for people to understand what may be difficult to comprehend, you know, I don't think that is an intention or that is an action that Afro-pessimists are really interested in at all. People have at times claimed, rightfully so often, that Marx, for example, is very difficult to read. But every Marxist also takes it upon themselves to explain the language of Marx and Marxism and sort of our theory and jargon, which to our benefit has a lot of it been integrated into mainstream, which is both a good and a bad thing. But it's another conversation. Yeah. So with that impenetrability, you know, we have, like you said, the notion of ontological. I mean, first off, the very word ontological is a concept in itself, right? It's both a term and a concept, right? It means it's of something's being, right? It's kind of folded into the fiber of something's being. And so to say that Blackness is sort of ontological death is to say that we're not dehumanized, which is sort of, it would be my assertion, is that we're constantly dehumanized and we're fighting dehumanization. But it's the very fact that we're not human at all, that we were born into death, that we were, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to make a very quick point on that note of, like, impenetrability. I actually remember, like, when I was initially reading some of the articles, actually it brought Nine Fernand's article on the national culture in which he talks about the native intellectual and just how ironic it was that a group of people who were, like, pinning their flag to the master Fernand were just so impenetrable to read for the lay person. Mm-hmm.
This is another point that you make in your article, though not explicitly in an entire sort of section, but there's a lot of, to me, posthumous sort of projecting. And what I mean by that is figures like Fanon or Steve Biko or revolutionary figures are sort of, after they've now died, their work is being, in my opinion, torn apart, and this Afro-pessimist logic is being read into them and projected onto them. So we see Fanon appear many times in your article, as well as in the text of Afro-pessimists. And I want you to speak a little bit about what that means, that his work is so heavily cited, when in reality, some of the very logics of Afro-pessimism are refuted by him directly through his sort of Marxist-Leninist orientation and decolonial. I mean, even calling him just a Marxist-Leninist to me seems unfitting. I would say like some kind of decolonial Marxist or something with that, you know, framework in mind. But so can you speak about that a little bit, as well as some of the points you make about his conception of the slave in the essay versus, you know, the Afro-pessimist conception of the slave?
So I think one of the important things to note about Fanon, he's for me a perfect example, and I go back to Black Skin, White Mass very often. It was really formative for me, but I think he's like one of the key examples of somebody who really comes to life in the context of struggle. And so I think there's been a sort of posthumous attempt to write out Fanon's involvement in the Algerian Revolution and how much he learned from that and his writings from that context and sort of his internationalism. And I think that comes from a couple of places. I think it firstly comes from this sort of attempts to read him simply as a sort of theorist of race because of the exceptionalism with which many scholars in the US treat the like particularity of the US. Then there's also the other element, which is that it challenges a lot of ideas which have become naturalized in political organizing, right? And in Black studies. So I think for me, the like attempt was to sort of wrestle back Fanon from the jaws of Afro-pessimism and the sort of logics which flow from that. So one of the main sort of ways I try to do that is in his analysis of the slave. And I think basically for me, the most important thing was to like highlight that whether Afro-pessimist logic treats the slave as a charismatically Black position and also treats the Black or the African as necessarily to be slave. And that is from where the logic of being non-human comes from. Fanon's understanding is of this sort of exchange or encounter as contingent. I think that sort of flows quite well from, first of all, an understanding from a non-US context. There is a tendency to treat the slave trade of the US as the transatlantic slave trade in its entirety. But also I think it's supplemented by a lot of what Fanon learns about how people understand that history from the continent, from the African continent itself, right? And actually, one of the introductions I use for one of the sections in the article is taken directly from my own experience of like going on slave walks when I was in Nigeria and seeing how differently these things are commemorated there. With Fanon, there are a number of different ways in which they use him. One of the main ways is to sort of treat Black Skin, White Mask as this stagnant text or this static text, which is not linked to anything he's written afterwards. And they don't really cite outside of Black Skin, White Mask. And even in there, it's mostly like the lived experience of the Black. It's like a few select essays in which actually I think Fanon is treating Black or African in a much more expansive sense than they allow him. But in particular, that sort of section, in that section of the article, what I'm trying to draw out is that Fanon's conception of the slave is not as, it's actually a critique of Hegel. He's arguing that in the transatlantic slave trade or in the slave trade that we understand as paradigmatic, what's happening is not a demand for recognition or mutual recognition, and that's where the claim for humanity comes from, but actually it's a transactional exploitative relation, right? What the master wants is not to be recognized as the master. What the master wants is labor. And I think that point gets missed a lot. I think for Afro-pessimists, if you're taking a group of completely different forms of domination under one banner of things which have happened to Black people or anti-Blackness, then of course it looks crazy, or of course it looks gratuitous, of course it looks senseless or without logic. But if you break it down into smaller chunks and you look at the experience of settler colonialism, if you look at the experience of colonization, if you look at the experience of the slave trade in the Americas, it's driving towards one form, right? It's driving towards exploitation. It's driving towards the extraction of value, either in terms of labor, in terms of land. And I think that point gets missed, but it's a point that Fanon is really keen to hammer home, because by his later work, what he's talking about is imperialism. And I think imperialism is a really important language as separate from colonization. Imperialism contains within it an analysis of the like forces of capital which drive it, right? And I think that's sort of missed by Afro-pessimists.
I mean, the language of imperialism is, especially in, you know, our current era of capitalism, is the ultimate. Right, like a Eurocentric or American-centric conception of race that not only doesn't deal with the realities of imperialism, but completely ignores them and disparages them, to me is wildly dangerous and is a wildly dangerous misreading of Fanon. another example, you know, I work with the Walter Rodney Foundation and with the Rodney family, and a lot of our time is spent at events. We do a lot of, in the springtime, a lot of educational seminars and workshops is combating misconceptions and intentional misreadings of Walter Rodney. Walter Rodney, to me, his most poignant, I can never pronounce that word, but you know what I'm trying to say. Yeah. One of his most important quotes is when he says, and I'm going to butcher this quote, I know for sure, but he essentially says, you know, it was the need for economics and exploitation that chose Africa as the landing ground for Europe to extract resources. It was then racism which chose direct colonial rule as the method of doing that, right? So he's sort of touching on the same topic about how we contextualize. I think within that, another point I want to make about your article, and I'm going to contrast this with a recent book I read and wrote a review of. You start each section off, for the most part, there's a few that you don't, but most sections you start off with quotes, right, from Fanon or from Wilderson and others, but you're almost contrasting two notes. Two quotes. You're almost contrasting them, which I think is a masterful way of structuring a chapter or a section of an essay or book. To contrast that, I recently read DeRay McKesson's book and reviewed that, and he starts off each chapter with a almost completely non-related inspirational quote by like majority Black liberals. There's like one Asada quote in there, but for the most part, it's, you know, and so I just had to have like get that out there and have a laugh at that because it's such just, you know, it's like a blatant difference in rigor and intention to me. So one of the critiques often leveled against Afro-pessimism is that it's not seeking to change anything, that it's essentially just a way of analysis. And to many, me and you, it's a limited way of analysis and problematic analysis. But what do you make of that? The fact that it's simply trying to explain a dynamic, it's not trying to suggest alternatives, it's not trying to map a way out in any kind of way? Or do you agree with that? Maybe you disagree.
Well, two things. I think firstly, it does a thing that, in that sort of response to it, actually that's how it defends itself a lot of the time, right? So like if we talk about the role of Afro-pessimism in breaking down possibility for solidarity, the response by people is Afro-pessimism cannot, or like the logic of anti-Blackness cannot stop people from organizing with people of other races, but it's actually the embedded anti-Blackness which is being exposed by Afro-pessimism, which forms the roadblock, right? And that's something that intersectionality does as well a lot, or people, intersectional theorists, right? So when they get criticized for producing a particular worldview, they come back and they say, well, intersectionality is very simple. It's just a very simple thing. It's just saying that there are interlocking forms of oppression. It's just describing something that exists in society already. It's just a descriptive tool in the same way that Afro-pessimists might refer to what they're doing as purely descriptive. But actually, I think it's more than that. Because I think once you accept it, and I remember in the political Blackness debate in the UK, I remember people being like, well, it's just a name, let's just change the name. And frankly, I don't care about if we call ourselves Black or whatever we call ourselves, right? But I think in conceding on that question, you're conceding a fundamental point about how the world works. And these sort of descriptive analyses which are offered, or they're taught to us as descriptive, actually what they're doing is providing a social theory. So they're changing the way we resist because they're telling us how they believe the world works and how they believe we can respond to that, right? So whether or not Afro-pessimism is saying, go out and organize purely with Black people, or if Afro-pessimists are saying, take up arms against the government, even if it's not saying any of those things or giving direct instructions on how to resist, it's telling us how we should resist because it's telling us what they believe will work or what they believe can get us somewhere, right? And I sort of go into this in my conclusion because I believe that if you accept all of the logic of Afro-pessimism, you find yourself in a position in which there are only two options in my belief. Either like everyone who's not black has to die for black people to be able to be human, which is a frightening concept. If people are so unchangeable, if people are so representative of the structures which create them, and so, and it, the process of struggle, because that's the problem with the notion that like there's no, there can be no solidarity, or as Frank Wilderson says, that the notion of a coalition or the entity of a coalition is an always anti-black formation. If that is true, and if the process of struggle can't transform people or change people or open them to the notion that black people are human, even if we do believe the Afro-pessimist line, then that means that they have to go for us to live. And that's a scary, that's one scary worldview. Mm-hmm. Or the alternative, which comes out whenever Wilderson gets asked about, well, what do Afro-pessimists want? What should we do? What is the end goal? And it's always something like, we're waiting for the end of the world, or we're placing ourselves in opposition to the world. Or you see what I mean? And all of these things are just sort of messianic, right?
Mm-hmm. So either we like... it's very nihilist, right? It's very nihilistic in the end. And I think that your point that this is sort of just an analysis of social life, but it deeply impacts interactions, because this nihilism, it creates this air of oppression Olympics, is what I like to call it, which we sort of discussed at the very beginning of this conversation. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to add that to it, but continue.
Yeah, I think also on the point of oppression Olympics, it creates this understanding of not being oppressed as being only sort of in the beginning stages of like fleshing out this sort of metaphor, but it becomes a sort of pathogen, right? You become, to be white is like something in your blood. It's not like a set of socializations which you can be unsocialized from through struggle. It's not something that can be transformed or taken out of you. Actually, what ends up happening is in political spaces, when an ally, in inverted comma, messes up, that's them just acting out what was in them already. So like allyship or solidarity is the abnormal, and the norm is actually just the playing out or hashing out of these forms of domination. And so there can never be proper trust. If you're going into a coalition or an organizing group and your expectation is that you're going to be let down by everyone who doesn't share exactly the same identity categories as you, because as a consequence of that, you have fundamentally opposing interests, then of course you're going to find yourself in a situation in which that coalition breaks down, because it becomes a competition for who can capture the voice, for who can be the voice of what your interests are. And if you understand those as fundamentally distinct or separate or oppositional, then there's no way it can work. And I think that's the sort of world that Afro-pessimism takes us to. That's the world that a lot of identity politics takes us to, which is really sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue for me, partly, is that actually Afro-pessimists will often like to describe themselves, and purely because they're talking about blackness as in opposition to the very category of human, they try to absolve themselves of any sort of relationship or similarities with contemporary identity politics. But I think Afro-pessimism is just one form of a whole bunch of contemporary identity politics. It's just black identity politics, in my view, because actually the logical structure of it and the conclusions of it are fundamentally quite similar to most other analyses that we can have, which lead us to a position of not being able to organize with people of other groups. I don't see how different it is to a queer politics who treat sort of straight people as having fundamentally different interests to us, or a gender politics which treats like men in feminist spaces as a sort of pathogen, or like trying to like sort of undermine us, or a feminist politics which is not even willing to listen to the voices of men. I think that's the kind of thing that takes us to where we are, the kind of gender policing, identity policing that we see. In the UK, part of the political blackgate saw actually the borders of what constitutes Black retreat. So like we had the Black students officer at the time was Somali. And like as the political Blackness debate heated up, and he was like in one camp, essentially he became non-Black because he was Somali. And like eventually over time what happens is that the borders of like sub-Saharan Africa become smaller and smaller because God forbid a North African refer to themselves as Black. And essentially what you get is the kind of identity policing which is similar to what you get from TERFs, right? Or from like anti-trans activists. It's obscene, and in no other circumstance would we sort of stand for it as people who claim to be committed to liberation politics. But for some reason it's suddenly okay. And if you saw some of the articles, I mean, we had the first Black president of our union of students elected, and in the articles in the aftermath, she was an Algerian woman, and like talking about the texture of her hair and the shape of her nose, and it's like these are like classical sort of examples of like pseudo race science.
A lot of it is borrowing, literally. Just, I mean, the real appropriation is this language is being appropriated and borrowed from our colonial oppressors, right? This is almost direct lines from the categorization that was placed on us, and the identitization that was placed on us through colonialism is being almost directly recreated in this sort of logic.
Yeah, and that's like down to the name of Afro-pessimism, because remember that like the Afro-pessimists used to be the people who didn't believe Africa was ready for self-governance.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it's become like one of the most predominant Afro-American theories of race, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have, so you have that language being borrowed and it's being repackaged. Actually, the book by the Field Sisters, Racecraft, makes this point so beautifully, which is like the sort of like one drop rule micromanagement of like racial identity demands to know like the exact constitutions of like someone's blood. Those are like things that died in the early 20th century and are literally being revived by African-American activists. That is frightening. Mm-hmm. I mean, they also make the incredible point that like a significant proportion of people in America who would identify themselves as completely white have at least 12% Black blood in them, right? So like even at the like hurdle of like empirics, it falls down. It is literally just taking the world which is visible to us and just treating it as if it's reality, material reality, when it's not.
I think it's difficult as well because, I mean, we know that race is not biological, right? Like it's not a biological determinant, but it is a very rigid social structure. And I think that the way we maneuver around that structure, we often, you know, when you're in a maze in a cornfield or something, you're supposed to put your hand on the right wall, and they say you put your hand on the right wall, it will always take you back to where you need to go. And if you put your hand on the left wall, you're going to walk in circles forever. And I think that oftentimes the ways in which we found to maneuver around race, whether it be our actions or just our very languaging, we think we have our hand on the right wall and we have it on the left wall. This to me is the perfect example. Not to change subject too much. Well, I guess this isn't changing subjects at all, but the term anti-Blackness, it certainly existed before the term, in my opinion, Afro-pessimism, but it's taken on a new life or a new non-life, if you want to do it that way. but it is outrageously popular, the use of the term anti-Black and anti-Blackness, often with no kind of post-descriptor, right? Not anti-Black racism or anti-Black prejudice or anti-Black epistemology, right? Like these are just the generalness of the term anti-Blackness is accepted. And I find the whole proposed theory of anti-Blackness, I find it so problematic. And I actually just last night was watching on YouTube a lecture where Angela Davis was talking about Afro-pessimism and critiquing it, which I find very fascinating because many Afro-pessimists would also claim to be big fans of Angela Davis. But nonetheless, it's this assertion that there is a hierarchy and that Blackness is always has been, always is, and always will be at the bottom. The problem with that is that's an American-centric way of conceptualizing race, and even in localities, right? So even in like certain localities in the U.S., that doesn't hold up. I think of my time living in Atlanta, where a large portion of the class that's gentrifying Atlanta are Black people with money, you know, kind of upper middle class and upper class Black people who themselves are contributing to this monstrous system. And on top of that, who are some of the number one supporters of ICE deporting immigrants who wouldn't dare, you know, even sit at the same table with someone if they knew they were undocumented. Yet, according to this anti-Blackness theory, we have to believe that they're somehow seen as below the undocumented immigrant, right? Mm-hmm. Who often is Black themselves. So to me, the very logic just doesn't hold up in many situations. And in order to believe it, you have to refute any history of Africa before the point of chattel slavery. Like, you have to not either not know it or not accept history. But can you speak on your thoughts of this Afro-pessimist version of quote-unquote anti-Blackness? You bring it up a lot in your article, or your essay, you quote the Wilderson essay, the irreconcilable anti-Blackness, and what that means. But I'd like to hear you kind of talk about that.
I think the main way in which, part of the reason why I turned to Afro-pessimism as a route into talking about anti-Blackness theory, is because the term anti-Blackness is incredibly prevalent contemporarily, but like most other identity politics, it sort of resists any kind of careful scrutiny of what it actually means or what the concepts embedded in it and what the logic of it is. And I think Afro-pessimism is probably one of the places in which we get the most honest analysis of the sort of position of those who use anti-Blackness as a sort of charge. So I think the main thing that Afro-pessimists are trying to do when they analogize anti-Blackness from all other forms of racism, or actually forms of racism from anti-Blackness, which is not in itself a form of racism because Black is not a race in Afro-pessimist theory, is what they're trying to do is say that for every other group in society who can be seen as harmed or who can be seen as oppressed, there is a logic to their oppression. So Indigenous peoples are oppressed, but there's a logic to it because the state needs their land. Workers are oppressed, but there's a logic to it because the boss wants to exploit them. Or sort of Muslims are oppressed. I mean, they never really get around to talking about why there's a logic to Muslim oppression or to Islamophobia. But I think basically what they're trying to say is that for forms of violence that Black people experience, it's gratuitous. It's for no reason. It's simply because society can hurt us that they do. Frank Wilderson, I don't know if I quoted it in the article, but he has a point where he says that anti-Blackness is the DNA of civil society. And essentially, where that takes us to, first of all, is ignoring the ways in which race and how race is conceived on a societal or structural level has changed in the last, at least since 9/11. But also in a longer trajectory. Actually, it was interesting that you mentioned Angela Davis. She has this chapter in The Meaning of Freedom, or this like speech that she put, Meaning of Freedom, where she talks about this sort of multiracial coalition which was built post 9/11, which included Black people against a new enemy, which was Muslims, and how actually a significant proportion of the Black political class were allowed a seat at the table in exchange for beating the drum for Islamophobia, beating the drum for imperialism, beating the drum for war. Or how do you explain the continued existence of majority Black countries on the continent in which you do just have abject poverty as a consequence of an political class which is ever enriching itself, right? So even that analysis of anti-Blackness, even that analysis of like Black as always the abject, Black as always the victim, just doesn't stand up to the most basic level of scrutiny. And one of the best examples I always like to bring up in cases like this is, it's sort of twofold. There's an instinctive, and I've noticed this actually from Black liberals, there's an instinctive sympathy with Israel, and particularly an instinctive sympathy with Ethiopian Israelis, who are essentially part of a settler class who are claiming or fighting for more rights within the context of a settler colony. So if you want to talk to me about always being at the bottom of the table or always being at the bottom of the pile, are we going to say that Ethiopian Israelis, who people rallied behind when they were talking about Black Lives Matter, who are very often on the front lines of fighting the war, or the front lines of the onslaught of Palestinians on murdering Palestinians, are you going to tell me that they operate at a position of weakness in relation to Palestinians? Are you going to tell me that actually it's Palestinian anti-blackness that needs to be rooted out before we talk about solidarity with Palestine, which is something that I hear very often? I don't know if you hear that in the US context. Mm-hmm. Or the fact that, like, a lot of the political class within a Black political class within America are also Israel supporters, mm-hmm. are also like ardent and vocal Zionists, right? And mm-hmm. I think that sort of like basic account of Black as always oppressed also gives the position of victimhood, which allows for any form of violence to be justified, as these people are better off than me, therefore it's okay for me to support this imperialist project, therefore it's okay for me to talk exclusively about incarceration in the US as in the context of like the disproportionate incarceration of Black people, not talk about Black sites, not talk about the fact that like Muslims and immigrants in Nigeria, in America, literally get disappeared by the state, right, with no trace, right? And I think even when we're talking about it as being specific to America or being an American-centric theory, it doesn't stand up to the like empirics of the context in America. You have to be incredibly blind to a lot of what's happened in the post 9/11 world. I think that the minority population in America, which is exclusively targeted by the state, is Black people. You have to be incredibly blind to the like policies of Trump, to what the Trump administration represents, to think that the like front line of anti-racist organizing contemporarily is an exclusively Black liberation platform, without an understanding of the ways in which anti-Muslim rhetoric has been built into the fabric of what binds the West together. Mm-hmm. The ways in which, like, I mean, NATO used to be, NATO's primary objective used to be battling communism, right?
Right.
And that entire fire of the like enemy of the West has been shifted mm-hmm. to Muslims. Like, yeah, and nobody has reckoned with what that means.
Mm-hmm. I think that on that topic, I just want to say this so that my listeners can, I always try to give as many resources as possible. So Hayao Dolatzai, I might have pronounced his name wrong, but he has a really incredible book that actually discusses that, and it sort of looks at this parallelly at the Black and Muslim struggle, where they intersect, and sort of the imperialist reckoning with that. It's called Black Star Crescent Moon. Mm. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's just so much we can continue talking about, and I know we only have a few more minutes left. But no, you're absolutely right. And one of the points Angela Davis was making, it's fascinating. Have you ever been thinking something and then you hear someone make the same point that you've been thinking, but they make it so much better than you? They like articulate it on a way another wavelength. But she was talking about Afro-pessimism and the global anti-Blackness theory, and she actually equates it to Black nationalism. And she says that it reminds her a lot of sort of toxic Black nationalist movements that arose in the 70s and 80s. And she says that, you know, that's kind of what she says is hiding, or is at the very core logic of it, is a sort of nationalism. Mm. And I find that fascinating, because a lot of my friends who are Afro-pessimists or who are kind of leaning down that route, there's two types of directions, I guess I can say, that they kind of lean. One of them is a very nationalist kind of politic. The other one is very anarchistic, where Afro-pessimism has led them to the disbelief in all states, or disbelief in the righteousness, or whatever you want to call it, of all states. And then there's another one, there's the other kind of track which is this assertion that the Black state, with no sort of, you know, liberatory framework around that, right? Just the ambiguously Black state will be the one that's finally not anti-Black, as if that doesn't already exist, I mean, across the African continent, right? and the Caribbean, and we see that they are still, like, hella entrenched in a class society. Nonetheless, you can read Groundings by Walter Rodney, and he goes into this, you know, in very good detail in one of his essays.
I think just on that Angela Davis point, obviously she's right, she's incredible, but she, one of the things that I noticed actually when picking out who I wanted to use to respond to Afro-Pessimists and what chapters and work that I wanted to use to respond is that in a lot of the quotes that I use in the article, actually the sort of person they're arguing against or their interlocutor is Black nationalists, or in the Panthers case, pork chop nationalists. Like, the point being that, like, actually a lot of the debates that we're having today is in large part because this sort of facade of a unified Black radical history, which treats Black radical history simply as like a series of memes, has forgotten that there were aggressive debates, arguments, fights between Black thinkers in the times that we're pulling from. So actually, I'd like you to be citing Huey Newton and Ron Karenga in the same sentence. It doesn't make sense for you to be like, it doesn't make sense for you to sort of treat Fanon as if he's literally just a logical extension of Césaire. It doesn't make, you see what I mean? And I think part of the issue is, and I guess it partly stems from the sort of sense that Black people have a shared set of interests, or Black people are more deserving of charity than intellectual charity than anybody else. It partly stems from this inability to see there as being not just surface level or strategic disagreements between Black political groups or Black political formations, but foundational disagreements about how the world works, about political systems, which are adequate for addressing some of the injustices that exist in the world. And like, I don't know how we move past that, except to try and revive that tradition of debate. I just hate the fact that so much of so many debates in Black studies, unless they involve Cedric Robinson or Adolf Reed, end up with people being like, we essentially agree, but we just have like minor differences or quibbles about how to get there, right? When actually the most proud tradition of Black radicalism is the strength of the disagreements between groups and the strength of the intellectual debate, because it produced a more rigorous theory of the world.
And I think that within an organizing sense, it's those debates, and not only the debates, but the willingness to be debated, right? And the willingness to be critiqued, or to believe in your own sort of your own rigor enough to be challenged, right? Like, that is also a step of the revolutionary, is to be ready to be critiqued and accept that. I think that's just an art we've lost. Any instance of critique is instantly likened to disparagement, or to quote unquote canceling, right? Which is the language of today, which I hate so much. an example of that is Audre Lorde and Amiri Baraka. They were contemporaries who, I mean, in my opinion, I think Audre Lorde was intellectually at this like superior developed stage at the time when her and Baraka were contemporaries. But nonetheless, they had major differences, especially when he was leaning more towards a Black nationalist tip. He had his, if you know, early in his career, he was somewhat homophobic and sexist. But when he was arrested, Audre Lorde still rallied dozens of poets together to protest and to raise money for his bail and to get him out. And from that, he learned and he grew, right? And of course, there's other things with his daughter and more personal things that grew him. But at the end of the day, it still happened. So I don't believe we're in a world today, and I don't believe we're in an organizing or movement world today, especially in the U.S., where I can speak to this, where that would be made possible. I would like to be proven wrong. I don't want to sound, not to be cheeky, but I don't want to sound pessimistic. That was my corny joke of the podcast. But I get one. Well, with that, we've been talking for a while now, so I'll let you go. But I want to thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I know you're going to be in the States possibly in a few weeks. Hopefully we can link up and maybe do a small part two or follow-up interview or something like that, because this was a very invaluable conversation.
Thank you so much. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And do you want to tell people where they can find you and your work, maybe on social media and elsewhere?
Primarily, you can find me on Twitter at Annie_ETC. I'm sort of currently at the moment, I'm currently burrowed away trying to work on a few things which are due to come out, but like all of that gets announced and talked about on my Twitter. And also I get into phone calls, but that's a separate point for another day.
Your phone broke up there the last minute. I didn't hear your last two sentences.
No, I was just saying that my Twitter is loads of flame wars, so that's another, but that's another thing for another day.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining, and this has been another episode of the Groundings Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you support it at patreon.com/halfatlanta. And if you have any questions, comments about the episode, feel free to shoot me a tweet at halfatlanta, and we can discuss.